C.S. Lewis once wrote a harrowing book, at least I think it is such, called The Screwtape Letters. I don't know if any of you like C.S. Lewis or have read his writings before, but he wrote this book called The Screwtape Letters. And in this book, Screwtape is the name of a senior demon in the mind of C.S. Lewis, and he's writing letters to his nephew, whose name is Wormwood. His nephew is sort of a junior demon, and Wormwood doesn't seem to have everything together. He's not very good at inducing his Christian to stumble. So Screwtape gives some advice about, if I were in your shoes and I were trying to get a Christian to sin, this is how I would do it. Of course, these letters are fictitious. I don't think that we need to read them and think that this is what's going on in the spiritual realm, that there are really demons having these kinds of conversations. But Lewis uses these fictitious characters, Screwtape and Wormwood, to shed some light on the kinds of things that Christians struggle with and ways that maybe we sin without really thinking about. And sometimes getting a peek behind the curtain of our enemies, like Screwtape tries to do in this fictitious book, sometimes getting a peek behind that curtain of one's enemies is very helpful in knowing how to combat your enemies. I want to do a similar thing like that, but with a historical account from the Bible in 2 Kings chapter 18. And I'd invite you to turn over to 2 Kings chapter 18. At this point in Israel's history, the northern tribes have already been taken into captivity. The Assyrians have come in and just wiped out really all of the regions surrounding the Judean tribes of Israel. They've wiped out all of the people, the Syrians, the Israelites to the north, the Moabites, the Ammonites. All of them have been just eradicated or taken into captivity by the Assyrian forces. And Assyria is a real world power at this time. Assyria is a really big deal. Assyria, eager to continue their conquest, invades Judah to take it over as well. They're just plowing people over. And so they think, here's this little nation of Judah. This will be no problem. We'll just go in and conquer these people like we have every other people. Well, Judah's king at the time was a man named Hezekiah. And Hezekiah was desperate for relief from these imposing Assyrian soldiers. And so Hezekiah offers to pay them tribute. I'll pay you off if you just go away, if you just leave us alone. I'll give you all kinds of money, all kinds of wealth. And what Hezekiah ends up doing is actually kind of interesting. In 2 Kings chapter 18, Hezekiah strips the doors of the temple of their precious metal and gives it to the king of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, even though, or rather gives it to Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. Even though Assyria isn't necessarily conquering Judah at this point, they are stripping things out of the temple that belong to God. But Assyria was particularly cruel. Assyria would not accept the tribute. Assyria insisted on completely defeating Judea. So, in 2 Kings chapter 18, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, sends three men and a great army with a message for the Judeans. And beginning in verse 19, Rabshakeh speaks on behalf of King Sennacherib, and he taunts the people in Jerusalem. He throws these accusations at them, these taunts, trying to get them to turn away from God, reject God's anointed king, and instead become devoted to the Assyrian king, to King Sennacherib. It might be interesting for us this morning, and this is what I want to do. I think it'll be interesting for us to see how it is that Rabshakeh tries to turn Israel away from their God. What kinds of things does God's enemy say to try to ensnare God's people to do something against God? Maybe by peeking behind the curtain, by seeing ways that God's enemies behave, we can learn some lessons to help us stand firm through our trials, when God's enemies come to us and try to discourage us. Let's begin in the text, and I'm going to point out four things here that Rabshakeh does in his taunt against Judea to try to discourage them and make them leave God's anointed king. The first thing Rabshakeh does is he questions their hope. He calls their hope into question. Let's read some of Rabshakeh's words. Look in 2 Kings chapter 18. This is in verse 19. Then Rabshakeh, who is the messenger from king of Assyria, Rabshakeh said to them, "Say now to King Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what is this confidence that you have? You say, but they are only empty words. I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom do you rely that you have rebelled against me? Now behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away? And has said to Judah and to Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem." Now, Rabshakeh is going to begin here by trying to crumble the hopes of Israel. Israel had made preparations. The Judeans had made preparations for this conflict. They were ready, or so they thought. They'd fortified their cities. They had made everything just as ready as it could be. They made preparations, physical preparations. And specifically, Rabshakeh is going to allude to a couple of those preparations. He says, you have gone to Egypt and you've asked for their military support, right? You've gone and you've tried to gather the Egyptians to back you against us. And of course, Rabshakeh is going to tear that down. And then he says, you've also made spiritual kinds of preparations. You've devoted yourself to Yahweh, and you believe that Yahweh is going to save you. You know, perhaps they were feeling pretty good about their chances to withstand Assyria. Perhaps Judah was feeling pretty confident that what they had going was something good, that they had made all of the physical preparations, they'd made all of the spiritual preparations that they could, and now they can stand against Assyria's siege and overcome victorious. But Rabshakeh mocks their preparations. He mocks all the things that they've done to prepare for the Assyrian onslaught. You say you're prepared, Rabshakeh says, but those are only empty words. You say you're ready for us, but to whom have you turned to defend yourselves? Egypt? You see what he says about Egypt? He says, here's the place where you turn, but Egypt, he says, is a broken reed. It's like a little stick that's kind of broken off of some kind of a tree limb. And if you try to lean on Egypt, if you try to lean out and put your weight on it, it's going to break in two, it's going to pierce you in the hand, and you're going to be worse off than if you never went to Egypt. He's mocking them for their choice of alliances. Who have you turned to defend yourself against Assyria? You turn to Yahweh? Did you turn to your God? You mean the God, Rabshakeh says, you mean the God whose altars Hezekiah has been tearing down? I don't know if you remember the story of Hezekiah's kingship. Hezekiah is remembered as a good king in Israel. And one of the reasons is because throughout Israel's history, they had been building these altars to false gods throughout their land. And in some cases, they built these altars to the true God, but they were worshiping God falsely because that's not where God told them to worship. And so Hezekiah comes through and Hezekiah starts tearing down these false altars. But to an outsider, I want you to think about what that looks like. To an outsider who worships a panoply of gods, just a pantheon of gods, you've got these outsiders looking in and saying, what's Hezekiah doing? Hezekiah is tearing down all of the altars of their gods. They must not have true faith in their gods. It may have looked like an opposition to Yahweh. In the ancient world, powerful gods had lots of altars. Powerful gods were those who were worshipped everywhere in every city. Why does Yahweh only have one altar? Rabshakeh is accusing them, is taunting them for their faith in Yahweh. You mean you're going to trust in that God who only has one altar, but our gods have all of these altars that people worship them from? You see, Rabshakeh calls into question everything that gave the Israelites hope. If you really want to discourage a Christian, if you really want to make a Christian question what he's doing, what she's doing, remove their hope. I mean, smash it. Smash their hope like Thanksgiving potatoes, right? Hope is the lifeblood of the Christian. Without hope for salvation, resurrection, without hope for heaven, why bother being a Christian at all? Why bother doing any of it if you don't have hope? Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 19 tells us that our hope, that we hope for better things. He says that in verse 9. Then he comes down in verse 19 and he talks about this hope that we have for things better, for things beyond this life of suffering. And he calls that hope an anchor for the soul. Our hope is an anchor for the soul. That is to say, our hope as Christians is what keeps us grounded and firm. The quickest way for God's enemies to discourage and overwhelm us is to remove our hope. Make us feel like we don't have answers to all of the objections to Christianity. Make us feel like there is no afterlife. Make us feel like our allies, our fellow Christians, will tear us down, will let us down. Make us feel like our God isn't very big. If you want to discourage a Christian, that's a surefire way to do it. Get them where it hurts. Hurt their hope. No one will fight a hopeless war. And Rabshakeh knew that. He knew that if he could make the people in Jerusalem feel hopeless, they would give it up. And they'd turn to the Assyrian gods. The second thing Rabshakeh does is he calls them to compromise. He calls them to compromise with the things that they've been doing. After he taunts them for their calling their hope into question, taunting them for their choice of defenders, he continues in verse 23. He says, "Now therefore, come, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for the chariots and for horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord's approval against this place to destroy it?" The Lord said to me, "Go up against this land and destroy it." You see, Rabshakeh knows that Hezekiah's men are devoted to God. Rabshakeh knows that God's men would not give up easily. So rather than just asking them to give up altogether, he says, "Let's make a deal. Well, let's make a deal. Let's compromise about this." Rabshakeh says, "If you will give yourselves to Sennacherib, that he would give them 2,000 horses to ride on." This is not just like for a hobby, like this isn't their hobby horses. This is war mechanisms, right? These are soldiers. These people are looking to fight and be victorious in their battles. Sennacherib says, or Rabshakeh says, "I can provide you with firepower." Maybe this is the equivalent of one nation giving another nation fighter jets in exchange for loyalty or something like that. Like, we're talking about major warfare here. And Sennacherib says, "I will give you whatever it is you need to fight your battles if you become loyal to me." Can those Egyptians, that weak reed of Egypt, can those Egyptians provide you with that kind of power? "Come make a deal with me," Rabshakeh says, "and I will benefit you far more than anyone else can." Let's make a deal. Let's compromise. You see, Rabshakeh appealed to Israel's sense of reason to induce them to make compromises, to do things that they know they shouldn't do. You know, Christians are often suckers for compromise. You know, God spends an inordinate amount of time telling his people to stay on course, not to turn aside to the right hand or to the left. Over and over and over again in the law, God says, "Do not turn aside to the right or to the left. Stay on course, regardless of what anyone tells you, regardless of what anyone promises you, regardless of whatever compromise seems good in the moment. Stay on course. Do not turn away to the right or the left." Deuteronomy 17, Deuteronomy 28, Joshua 1, Proverbs 4, over and over and over. Don't turn aside. Why does God have to go over this again and again and again? Why does God have to remind us again and again and again not to compromise, not to turn aside, not to go anywhere else? It's because his people are inclined to compromise when given the chance. It's because we are inclined to compromise when we find something that we like or something that seems easier to us. A surefire way to get God's people to sin is to invite them to compromise. Invite them to make a deal. If you skip worship this evening, imagine the work you could do around the house. That's a good trade-off. Don't you see the value of, you don't have to worship God every time, right? It's not that important to come to Bible study because there are other things that you could do in its place. If you exaggerate the truth here, you could really get a leg up in your job. You don't have to tell the truth 100% of the time. If you just compromise this once, it could be so good for you. If you just tone down your Christianity, you know, you could really smooth over a lot of relationships in your family. When the bargain is enticing enough, people will eventually take it. Rabshakeh knew that. Rabshakeh tried to sweeten the deal. I'll give you 2,000 horses you will never want for military power again if you become loyal to us. God's enemies today know that as well. The third thing that Rabshakeh does in his taunt against God's people is he makes sin appealing to them. He makes it something that looks good, something that looks looks appealing. He says in verses 31 and 32, he says, "Make your peace with me and come out to me and eat each of his vine and each of his fig tree and drink each of the waters of his own cistern until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive trees and honey, that you may live and not die." Rabshakeh takes things a step further here. Rather than asking for compromise, he tries to reframe the Judeans' way of thinking. You think that if you come to Assyria, we're just going to be bad people and we're not going to be able to get along and we're going to kill you like we killed all the other people before you. But you're thinking about this all wrong, Judah, Rabshakeh says. It's no longer let's make a bargain, but now make peace with me, Rabshakeh says. Life in Assyria, as Rabshakeh puts it, would be peaceful. It would be luxuriant. It would be satisfying. You would never want for anything if you came and lived in Assyria and were devoted to me. In fact, Rabshakeh makes Assyria sound an awful lot like God's promised land, doesn't he? A land flowing with honey, a land of grain and new wine. This is almost the same language that God used to bring his people into this promised land. I'm going to give you this great land. And now the king of Assyria comes along and says, I want to bring you to a better land, better than what God can give you, your God. Of course, it was nothing like God's promised land. It was a land of horrible rulers who defied Yahweh and mercilessly ravaged other peoples. Even so, Rabshakeh made this ungodly place seem very, very appealing to Judah. Christians can be made to stumble when sin is made to look appealing to them. This has been a struggle from day one. Way back in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, the text tells us that Eve saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that it was desirable to make one wise. The serpent didn't have to tell her about all of the bad things that would happen if she ate the fruit. All he did was tell her how good it looked in the moment. In James chapter 1 and verses 14 and 15, James describes something about where sin comes from. Where does sin come from? It comes from the lust. When the lust is full born in our hearts, when it comes out, that's when temptation hits. That's when we sin. It's the desires of our heart. We are enticed to think that sin is something good. And don't fool yourself. No one is a match for the allurement of sin when it is properly dressed up. You think about various kinds of sexual sins in the world today that are glorified in our culture. Pornography, premarital sex, homosexuality. And the selling point is this: if it's consensual, there's no harm. We dress it up. We make it look good. You think about things like the way we use our tongue, like gossip in the workplace or among our families or in the church or whatever it be. And you say, well, we're not really doing anything to hurt anybody. We're just shooting the breeze. We're building our relationship by talking about someone else. We try to dress things up in our minds. You think about the fact that misplaced priorities, putting other things before God, putting other things before worship. And we say, well, we're pursuing good things. We're trying to get our kids into extracurricular activities. We're trying to get up in our education, and we're putting things above God, but it's a good thing that we're doing. Anything can be dressed up and made to look good. People don't sin because they think sin is repulsive. People don't defy God because they think how horrible that is. They do it because they see there's good there, because something is made to look appealing to them. Rabshakeh knew that. He tried to dress up this horrible land away from God's presence. And God's enemies today know that as well. The fourth and final thing that Rabshakeh does in his taunts against God's people to try to get them to fall away from their God is he discredits their God. He discredits them. Rabshakeh ends with perhaps the biggest taunt of all in verses 32 through 35. He says, "Do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you. saying, "The Lord will deliver us." Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Shepharvaim, Hena, and the Avah? Have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their land from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Israel from my hand? Rabshakeh unequivocally affirms that Yahweh would not be able to deliver his people. In a way, this is where Rabshakeh began when he was removing his hope, removing Israel's hope. He said, you've leaned on Egypt. Oh, and you've also tried to lean on Yahweh, but Yahweh won't be able to save you. Now he comes back to that point in full circle fashion, and he makes it more forcefully now. Rabshakeh just invites Judah to look around. Have any of the surrounding nations' gods stopped Assyria's expansion? And the answer to that is no. Judah was kind of sitting alone, like on a little island there, surrounded by nations that had been conquered and overrun by Assyria. Not one of the nation's gods stopped Assyria. And in verse 34, at the very end of verse 34, did you notice one of the nations that Rabshakeh mentions? He says Samaria, which is not really a nation, but it's the capital of the northern tribes of Israel. He says all of these other nations have gone, and even your brothers to the north have fallen, and your God didn't save them. And do you think that your God will be different? You think that now this God is going to stand up to Assyria, whom none of the other gods could stand up to? You see, Rabshakeh just discredits Yahweh altogether. Your God is not powerful. He's not able to defend you. He discredits their God. If you can remove God from the equation, God's people are simply a group of people. If there's no God in God's people, then there's no aim, there's no purpose, there's no hope, there's no a goal. If God is not able to fight our battles, then why should we bother following him at all? If God is not going to be victorious in the end, then is he really God at all? Christians cannot be Christians if Yahweh is not God. Christianity falls apart. So, if you want to make a Christian stumble, discredit God. Make them doubt his integrity. Why would a good God allow such bad things to happen? Make them doubt his strength. Maybe God just can't do anything about this evil. Maybe he's not powerful enough. Make them doubt his existence. Rabshakeh knew what God's enemies today know. That if you discredit God, there is no reason to be devoted to him. Rabshakeh taunts God's people. He comes at them hard. He tries to discredit their hope. He invites them to compromise with them. He leads them to look at sin in an appealing way. And he discredits the God of heaven before them, all in an effort to get them to become loyal to the king of Assyria and reject God's anointed king. These are some of the same tactics that God's enemies will use today to bring us down, to discourage us, to dissuade us from our loyalty to the King of Kings. Are you ready for these kinds of objections? Are you ready for these kinds of taunts in your life? Are you prepared? Are you confident in your hope? Are you confident in the preparation that you have made, that the resurrection will be, that the heavenly hope is real, that salvation is yours? Can you, when somebody taunts you and tries to tear down your hope, to smash your hope, can you stand up and affirm, "No, I have this hope no matter what you say"? Do we have that kind of hope? Are you ready to stand against compromise? When God's enemies come along and try to entice you to make a trade, you give and I'll give a little, are you willing to stand firm and not turn to the right or to the left? Are you ready to make that stand against compromise? Can you reject the allurement of sin? When sin is dressed up and made to look appealing, made to look pretty, when it's all, you know, dressed up nice and neat, are you ready to make a stand and say, "I still will not do that"? Do you have unshakable faith in your God? That he is powerful, that he will deliver. I want to take one more lesson from 2 Kings chapter 18. And I want to just mention to you how Judah handled these taunts. In 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 36, down at the end of the chapter, the text tells us exactly how the people of God dealt with these taunts from Rabshakeh. But the people were silent and answered him not a word. For the king's commandment was, do not answer him. In response to Rabshakeh's taunts, Israel said absolutely nothing. It was absolute silence in response from the city of Jerusalem. I think here's where they take their advice, perhaps from Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 4. Do not answer a fool according to his folly. Right? Here's a place where somebody is taunting them who is not in any kind of position to be in any kind of real discussion. Rabshakeh doesn't care about their response to his claim. He only cares about getting them to be loyal to him. So in this case, they apply Proverbs 26 pretty well. Don't answer a fool according to his folly. But perhaps even more noteworthy is the why. Why did they remain silent? Why didn't they answer anything? The text tells us there in verse 36, I don't know if you caught it. It says in verse 36, they did this because the king's commandment was, do not answer him. The reason the children of Israel remained silent is because they were loyal to the king. They were loyal to God's anointed. They didn't give in to Sennacherib. They didn't give in to the messenger Sennacherib sent, Rabshakeh. They followed the king that God had set on his throne despite Rabshakeh's taunts. So the question for us is, are we loyal to the King of Kings? Are we willing to stand up in the face of taunts and say nothing because we trust in the king, because we follow the king, because we serve the king? If that's your need today, if you need to build your faith and your strength in that regard, we want to help you with that if we can. We want to encourage you to be the kind of Christian that God calls you to be the kind of servant of the King that Christ expects you. If we can help you come to Christ, we want to do that. If we can study with you, we want to do that. But above all, we want you to be loyal to the King. And if we can help you with that, why don't you come now as we stand and as we sing a song of encouragement.